Greetings and welcome to the latest edition of the Entheogenic Evolution Podcast. As always, I am your host, Martin, and I'm happy to have you with me today. For this week's episode, I am joined by author Chris Bennett to discuss his very large book, Liber 420, all 792 pages of it. And he's joining me from out in the middle of nowhere, pretty much, on the west coast of Canada, out in the forest. And just a couple technical notes about today's episode. This is actually the first episode I've ever done using Zoom because Skype was not working for Chris. And, you know, this is just a plug, actually, for Skype. Well, not even for Skype. There's an exterior program called Call Recorder that you can install in conjunction with Skype. And it produces superior audio recordings than what is made available through Zoom. And one of the great benefits of it is that it actually separates out the audio tracks so that I can mix and edit my part separately from the person that I'm interviewing. Excuse me. But with Chris, we had to use Zoom, and there's a little bit of a delay, and there's some little funky audio issues here and there. So just know that the audio quality isn't quite as good as it normally is here on the podcast because we had to use Zoom. Anyway, we'll be getting to that very, very shortly. First, just a couple quick announcements. I do want to thank Matthew and Arthur for making donations to the Entheogenic Evolution podcast over this past week, and also for James, who set up a monthly PayPal donation. Of course, if you would like to make a PayPal donation to the podcast, just swing on by my personal webpage, martinball.net, and there's a PayPal link at the top right of the page. There's also a link that you could join up as a member over at Patreon and make a monthly contribution that way, and also get the benefits of being a member of my Patreon page, which of course is patreon.com/martinwball. And hopefully coming up in just a couple weeks, I got an email from a group that is looking to legalize psilocybin and MDMA therapy throughout all of Canada, and got an email asking if I'd be interested in doing an interview here in the podcast with that group, and sounds exciting to me, so maybe that'll be coming up in the next few weeks on the podcast. We'll get back into Being Infinite next week, but perhaps that will be the next interview that we do here. Yeah. Hope everybody is doing well. Hope that your health is good. If you have contracted coronavirus, I hope it's a mild asymptomatic case for you. Definitely these are interesting times right now. The vaccine is now making its way around the world. And of course, there's a lot of resistance from people about anti-vaxxers. I am not one of those. Anti-vaccine people, you know, they've got their beliefs, but unfortunately they're just beliefs. You know, the whole anti-vax movement was started by a doctor who lost his medical license for malpractice and publishing fraudulent materials. So the whole anti-vax thing is actually built on fraud. Just so you know, I mean, there's probably some anti-vaxxers who listen to this podcast, but just so you know, there's not solid scientific evidence for your position. And in fact, the whole movement was started by medical fraud. But, you know, just the way things go. But anyway, yeah, we've got the vaccine is now making its way around the world. We'll see what that does for coronavirus. But anyway, we don't need to get into it here. Let's go ahead and get into our talk with Chris Bennett. Of course, he also runs the Soma Institute out there in British Columbia, and we talk a little bit about that, and we talk about his work as an independent researcher and scholar, and we got a lot to talk about in regards to cannabis in history. So it's fun. There's a long, deep history there. So let's get into it with Chris Bennett, author of Liber 420 and also Cannabis and the Soma Solution, and a couple other books as well, which he mentions here in the interview. Hope you enjoy. Talk to you next week.
But one of the places that I like to start in interviews is getting to know the person behind the book.
There you go.
In this case, that would be you. So, yeah. So here we are. On the Entheogenic Evolution podcast, my guest is Chris Bennett, and he's the author of several books, which we're going to learn more about in today's podcast. And also, Chris, I know that you have recently opened up the Soma Institute, which we'll want to hear about. And I know that you've run the Urban Shaman in downtown Vancouver, in BC, British Columbia, up in Canada. And you've been involved on the 420 scene, on the cannabis scene for a long time. So you're the green man. And we're gonna be talking all about cannabis today. But Chris, just welcome to the show. It's great to see you. It's great to connect with you here on Zoom. This is the first interview I've done for the podcast on Zoom. So we'll see how that goes. But it seems to be stable so far.
Yeah. Well, pleasure to connect with you as well, Martin. Hopefully my connection's good. I live in the mountains, so it's a satellite. Things are well here, you know, and it's going to be a pleasure to go over some of this stuff with you.
Yeah, so I mean, we're going to talk about your book, Libra 420. And it's 792 pages long. I'm looking at the PDF right here. And so, you know, I'll admit right from the start, I have not read every word of this book, but I've definitely skimmed through the whole thing and really impressed with the level of research and the historical depth, because this goes all the way back to ancient times, really bringing it up pretty much into the Renaissance and modern world. And but let's start with you and how you got interested in cannabis. Like, what's your backstory, man? Let's hear the backstory of the green man.
You know, I had a although I try to take a very like anthropological kind of approach to history when I write about it and the history of cannabis. Oddly enough, I myself, my whole trip started with this really powerful religious experience I had in 1990, and what happened is I guess it was a variety of things that happened. And the first of these was I found out about industrial hemp and all the applications of industrial hemp through some documentary I'd seen. And mm-hmm. where I was living on the west coast of Vancouver Island, in Iqaluit, in a small logging town at that time, was in the midst of this great controversy over logging one of the last old-growth coastal rainforests, Clackwood Sound. And I'd worked in sawmills. My brother was actually the chairman for the loggers union in the area. And it was always like it had never been an issue before. But then all of a sudden, there were all these people there talking and protesting, you know. And I was like, oh, this seems like it could be an answer to this situation. And coinciding with this, was this real big controversy in Canada about a Catholic orphanage, Mount Cashel, and the priest had been exposed for molesting children. Mm. And I was like, weird, I never really read the Bible. I thought that was supposed to be about other stuff, not that type of stuff. And for some reason, I decided to get a Bible. And then one night, I was working as a night watch for that time. I was a surfer. I lived out on the West Coast, and I was there so I could surf, right? That was my whole trip. And I had this job working a few nights a week as a night watchman to subsidize my surf living. And I was there one night, late at night, and I grew cannabis. I was smoking some weed I grew in this empty lunchroom. And I was reading the paper, you know, and the Gulf War had started. And then there was this ad. This is before the internet, so TV and stuff was in the paper, right? And there was an ad for a sermon by Pat Robertson. And it was Revelations 18, the fall of Babylon. And I was like, oh, weird. You know, he's saying this is in the Bible. And I thought, oh, I got that Bible. I'm going to read the book of Revelation right now. And so I got this book of Revelation out, and I started reading it. And the prophet John, he's given a scroll, and he puts it in his mouth, and it tastes as sweet as honey, and he swallows it. It turns bitter in his stomach. And then he begins to prophesy. And after that, I was like, whoa, you know, I started reading it, and there was all these references to billowing smoke of incense and with the prayers of the saints and sackcloth. And I was, this is trippy shit. And I got to the end of the Bible, and I read the last verse. On either side of the river of life stood the tree of life, bearing 12 manners of fruit, yielding its fruit each month, and the leaves of the tree are for the healing of the nations. And when I read that, I had this, this is the turning point of my existence, you know. I had this feeling like light just beamed into me, and it was, this is a reference to cannabis and its use in the world and the religions and its industrial applications and stuff. And I was like, wow, you know, and wasn't really into like reggae or anything like that, but I started thinking that must be what these Rastafarian guys are talking about when they talk about cannabis, you know? And I started tripping out, and I called my wife up at the time, and she thought I was having a mental breakdown. She started bawling. And then the next day I got up and I was like, was there anything to that? Or was I just like tripping out, you know? And after that, I'd look out at these clear cut mountains, and there was no hemp activists or cannabis activists in BC at that time. And, you know, BC became a complete hotspot over the next decade. And cannabis is now legal in Canada. There was not even a cannabis movement in Canada at all at that time. And after that, I just couldn't smoke a joint without feeling like I was not doing something I was supposed to be doing, you know? And I thought, well, I'm going to for sure promote these industrial applications of hemp as a solution of environment versus a job. And if there's anything to this religious stuff, then somebody somewhere else will know about this and I'll start just looking on it, right? And I'm like a high school dropout, right? So I had no background in, you know, researching or academia. And my earliest stuff is, you know, sounds kind of crazy, but I slowly started learning the ins and outs of history and compiling, you know, references whenever I came across it. And then that led to like four books now, Lever 420s, four books. And, you know, considerable, considering from the background I came from, considerable academic support for that work. And then, you know, since then, in this last year, there's been the archaeological evidence out of Arad, Jerusalem, confirming something that I've been saying for decades, that the Hebrews were burning cannabis inside the temple as a means of communicating with God, in their view.
Yeah, so this has been kind of a major theme in sort of the modern psychedelic movement, modern cannabis movement, is kind of reassessing ancient traditions and really looking at what kind of mind-altering substances were used. And, you know, as I'm sure you're aware, you know, I have my PhD in religious studies, and I always talk about how, as a graduate student going through graduate school in religious studies, I think psychoactive substances were mentioned like maybe twice in my entire career as a graduate student. And, you know, it's pretty clear now that actually the ancients were getting high. There are disputes over what they were using. And I myself, I don't have skin in the game in the sense that, you know, I'm not on one side or another, that like, oh, that's definitely this or definitely that. I'm very interested in all the information. But I think that just at a general level, just the basic recognition that psychoactive substances and psychedelics and entheogens have been a part of religion and spirituality pretty much from the beginning of human history. I think that that's just an indisputable fact at this point. And, you know, we can argue over the details, and certainly someone like yourself is kind of like an archaeologist, you know, you're a historian, but kind of like an archaeologist, that you're digging through all of these ancient texts, all of these ancient references. You're looking at art, you're looking at poetry, you're looking at historical documents, you're looking at religious documents, and, you know, you're putting the dots together to create the picture. And like I said, I haven't read the whole book, Lever 420, because it's 800 pages and I haven't had time to do the whole thing. But I mean, the amount of footnotes, the amount of references, and you definitely make very compelling arguments through here. So clearly you've done your research.
Like, I think one of the beauties about cannabis is there's actual, like, you don't have to speculate as much as maybe some of the other entheogenic substances, in the sense that we have solid archaeological evidence in many cases. And also solid textual evidence. Cannabis itself, you know, is the root words for it go back to Proto-Indo-European languages, right? And so sometimes it's directly mentioned in texts, like say in Zoroastrian texts, where it appears as Banga, or the Pahlavi counterpart of that is Mang. We know those are references to cannabis, you know? And so that's, I think, what really is solid about when we talk about cannabis history. It's not as speculative as some of the other stuff. It's not based on, say, oh, this palm leaf looks like a pot leaf or something like that, right? Yeah. You know, there was like, you know, when I was writing about the Hebrew words, I was referring to this term cannabosom before the archaeological evidence showed up verifying this use. And I thought that was pretty solid, but based on other etymological evidence, like the Assyrian word kanabu and the similar ways they used it, right? And so I always felt fairly confident in it. But, you know, something like real solid archaeological evidence, that's the grail, you know, in these things, and really is the confirmation, that that type of confirmation that we need. I also think, you know, I've been critical of some other researchers, and I think there that's needed in this scene, because there's just some really loose speculation out of there, and not everybody can be right. You know what I mean? It's like, yeah, you're talking about things like theories of history and stuff like that, competing theories. Well, let's get to the truth of the matter, and let's put it all out on the table and compare and, you know, and weigh them up against each other. And I don't think that people should be afraid of that. We all get pretty attached. I know myself, I get pretty heated in some of these debates and stuff like that. But, you know, we're talking about, you know, in my mind, you know, like revealing the sacraments of the ancient world that gave birth to modern religion and our culture. And that's a big thing, you know. I think this archaeological and textual evidence that we're rediscovering in our own time about the origins of religions and entheogens is as much a threat to fundamental religion as Darwin's theory of evolution was to the myths of creation in Genesis, because what it shows is the plant-based origins of religion, you know, right? And right now we have evangelical religious people in control that don't care about the world that we live in because of this fantasy that they've developed, of angels in heaven and discarnate this and that, without realizing the plant-based shamanic origins of these types of ideas. And I think that's the paradigm shift of our age, is really getting that into the mainstream. We can kind of see it entering into the mainstream with Brian Maresco's The Immortality Key in a real big way, which is on the New York Times bestsellers list, and which proposes entheogenic origins for Christianity as well, right? So it is starting to kind of get in there. Whether it'll happen quick enough to turn around current world events and paradigms, I don't know. But it's certainly worth striving at. And it's something I've been working at for 30 years, that's for sure.
Yeah, and I think it's a real issue when modern religions have evolved or moved away from their roots. And, you know, I'm definitely 100% in agreement with you. I think that evangelical Christianity is a form of institutionalized delusion. I mean, they're just living in a complete fantasy world. And it's completely disconnected from the historical roots of Christianity. And, you know, we see something very similar where in, you know, the Eastern side of things, where we have modern day yogis and gurus and saints saying that use of psychedelics or cannabis is somehow cheating and that it's not a real spiritual practice. And, you know, the evidence of where does all of this stuff come from historically, it all comes from cannabis and psychedelics and wines infused with various herbs and mushrooms and all kinds of stuff. And so for any modern day religious figure to say that somehow plant-based or chemical-based, molecular-based religious experience is somehow inauthentic is just, and it's in complete denial of human history. And this is where, you know, as someone who went through religious studies and has taught religious studies, you know, I've always emphasized this with my students, and it blows their mind because they've never heard any of this. And like I said, I myself was not really exposed to this at the graduate level as a student, but this, I mean, it's undeniable now. And
yeah, you know, in the 19th century, the British Raj really did a number on reprogramming the culture in regards to these things. And there's a great book, Cannabis, Colonialism, and Madness, and it details how when the British Raj went into India and the Mideast, one of the biggest obstacles that they faced in dominating the public and maintaining their respect was actually sadhus and fakirs, who many times were like stoned out of their gourds and were commonly, you know, it was like so common in those days for them to be high all the time. And they would like walk in front of the carriages and stuff like that naked, you know, with like nobody's business. Yeah. And they'd have to stop and it'd be like for this little naked guy and he'd be like backing them back. But these figures were respected religious figures in the community. They still are, you know what I mean? Chum smoking sadhus and stuff like that. You'll see businessmen kissing their feet and stuff like that at the Kumbh Mela. You know, they still are. They represent a radical Dionysic element of the Indian religion. But they're still respected figures. And so what the British Raj did is that they started saying, well, these guys are acting peculiar. They're obviously crazy, and it's from the cannabis. And they built all these asylums in India and in the Mideast, and they just started grabbing these guys off the streets and tossing them into the asylums. And then if you wanted to make it with the British Raj, you had to adapt to the British Raj's ways and views. And so the culture, particularly the upper classes of the culture, the Brahmin and people like that, the elites of the Indian cultures, you know, more and more culturally adapted, but, you know, didn't ever completely disappear. You could go to Shivaratri and many places in India, Nepal, and people, regular city people are partaking of cannabis in honor of Lord Shiva, or the festival of colors. They're throwing paint and drinking bong and stuff like that. Some elements of this is still survived, but it's a shame just how much they degraded the spiritual relationship that was held in the East with sadhus and bongs and ganja and fakirs and the use of hashish. You know, it's this stuff will get you killed in some of these regions nowadays.
Yeah. And, you know, and even you telling your own story of sort of your revelations with the Book of Revelation, it reminds me of kind of my own experience. It was my second time tripping on psilocybin mushrooms. And I was alone in a room, and as the mushrooms were coming on, I was looking at just a white wall, just a blank white wall. There was nothing on it. And I was watching it, and all of a sudden, there were all these very, very distinctive Celtic knots appeared all over the wall. And that literally was the moment where I was like, oh, maybe this is what they mean by the spirit world. That, you know, I had grown up in a scientific materialist, atheist household, and, you know, I don't consider myself spiritual or religious now, but at the moment it was like, oh, maybe it's not all just a bunch of bullshit. Maybe that they're talking about altered states of consciousness and what is made accessible through that. And, you know, I learned later that, you know, the Liberty Cap mushroom grows in Ireland and England, and, you know, the Celts very well might've been eating these. So maybe I'm seeing the same things that they were seeing. And this is where their art came from. And so that was my own personal epiphany that, you know, because definitely my attitude was that all religion and all spirituality is just a bunch of made up bullshit. But then this was the moment of thinking, well, maybe there's something to it. And it's not what I've believed about it. And it's also not what most mainstream religious people think religion is. But it's related to these alterations of consciousness and what is made accessible through that.
You know, I think a lot of it is like accessing what Jung called the unconscious, or Freud called the subconscious. And I think there's a real parallel with magic in this, you know, and that one of the ways that cannabis seems to be repeatedly used in magical circles has been with these items and other psychoactive substances as well. I'm sure they would have used mushrooms if they knew about them. There is some indications that magicians like Eliphas Levi, he certainly wrote about psychoactive mushrooms. But these magic mirrors are like black opaque mirrors, and you would stare in them to see visions, and you'd like continually stare until you saw a vision. And strangely enough, when you use psychoactive substances, the visions come a little quicker and better, better high definition, high definition visions they weren't getting without the addition of this. And we see recipes in 16th century grimoires like the Grimoire of the Cunning Man, or Sefer Raziel, Liber Salomonis, or the Book of Oberon, specifically for seeing spirits and things in mirrors and applying cannabis and other substances as well, but specifically cannabis and a lot of the recipes in those three books. We see this again occurring in the 19th century with, you know, cannabis and again, sometimes other drugs, tropamine, things like henbane and opium and stuff like that, with magicians like Pascal Beverly Randolph, Alphonse Cahagné, and they're all writing about mirror scrying with drugs, and there's direct references to all this. This is all like direct reference, no speculation here. Mm-hmm. In the same period is when the idea of the unconscious or the subconscious actually began to take root. And we can go back to figures like Dr. J.J. Moreau, who was a member of Le Club de Hashishin. And he was understanding cannabis as a sort of a form of temporary madness and comparing it to the dream state. And this is what led to the unconscious, the subconscious, right? Mm. And interestingly enough, with cannabis in daytime use, melatonin levels, according to studies that were done on this in the 80s, could spike as much as 2,000 times normal daytime levels, right? And this may be why a lot of people report losing a lot of dreaming when they smoke a lot of cannabis, because their melatonin's been spiking all day, and this has a direct relationship with dreaming, melatonin. And they go to night and it's kind of drained out, which might be good in some cases for people like PTSD who sometimes don't want to dream, right? But I've noticed an alternative effect of waking up at about 4 a.m, puffing a joint and going back to bed and having the most intense dreams that I ever had, totally lucid, vivid dreams. And this is on numbers of occasions, and I know other people that have experienced this. And this is why I put this use to the magic mirrors. I think that they were kind of tapping into that same sort of thing with the melatonin frequency, and the one speaking to them from the mirror was in fact the one that tells them their dreams at night, you know. Yeah. And what is that that tells us our dreams at night? You know, we're in the dream, we're all the characters in the dream, and we're the narrator of the dream, and it's our subconscious or unconscious, and it's by bringing that element up into our conscious mind that we achieve the marriage of the sun and the moon in alchemy, the sun being our daytime awakened consciousness and the moon being our nighttime consciousness that kicks in and dreams by that. And it's by bringing those two together in union that we achieve, you know, genius and things like that.
Yeah. So for those listening, I just want to kind of reiterate again that this is all about what the book Liber 420 is all about. And just going back, I mean, we're kind of jumping around here, but it goes all the way back into ancient human history, all the way up into modern psychology. You have a section on Shakespeare and getting into the unconscious, and then sort of the magical traditions that were sort of rekindled by like Aleister Crowley and the, you know, OTO and groups like that. And so, I mean, this is why there's just such a wealth of information for us to talk about here. But let's go back just a moment, because I remember seeing this, it was some months ago now, about the archaeological discovery. I think it was in Jerusalem. I'm sure you know the details more than I do, that found clear evidence of use of cannabis inside a Jewish temple. So
yeah, maybe this is a temple site from the 8th century BC in Arad, Jerusalem. And it's a miniature version of the Holy of Holies described in the Bible. And its size is important here. You know, it's probably about a six by eight little cubicle, right? And they found two altars, one frankincense had been burned on, and the other altar, cannabis resins had been burned on. There had been manure there, but manure was a common lighting fuel back in those days.
Yeah.
And is even referred to in the Bible for this. So this was a resin product of cannabis, not raw cannabis. There's no evidence of seeds or leaves or any sort of burnt matter that way. Potent cannabis resin product, burnt inside a room that is about the size of a walk-in closet, you know, so the ultimate holy hot box. This is really fascinating. And there's been a lot of talk about this archaeology. I've been listening to a lot of the programs out of Israel and stuff like that. And they're saying that this site like represents some sort of heretical act of worship, you know, because it wasn't in the Holy of Holies. But that's probably correct. And this is why it fits so well with these references suggested by the Polish etymologist and anthropologist Sula Bennett in the 30s, a Hebrew term, kanabasim, which I'd been writing about for decades before this archaeological discovery. And in her references to kanabasim, the initial reference appears in Exodus 30:23. You know, Moses, who of course met the angel of the Lord and flames of fire from within a burning bush, is commanded to make this holy anointing oil with about 6.5 pounds of this herb, cannabossum, mixed with myrrh and cinnamon, and put into an olive oil base. And olive oil is actually quite good for extracting THC out. And then this oil was put on the body, and your body is a big organ, fatty soluble, and oils can pass through that way. But it was also burnt on the altar of incense, much like this situation as described in the Arad temple. Now, initially, these references to cannabossum are favorable. But as things progress, there's like 6 specific references that Sula Bennett pointed to. It's clear that the use of cannabossum became associated with the worship of the goddess in the ancient world. And we know from archaeological finds now, all throughout the Jewish kingdom period, that there's these goddess figurines that have reemerged. And there's also inscriptions and illustrations. And some of these illustrations, one particularly, refers to Yahweh and his Asherah. And this was his wife through much of the kingdom period, right? And the cannabis use was directly associated, became directly associated with Asherah, the goddess Asherah. Now, whether it originated under her cult, which was probably older than the Canaanite, the Hebrew Yahweh, and filtered into the Yahweh cult, or whether it originated with the Yahweh cult, you know, it's hard to tell from these particular references. But we do know that similar Near Eastern goddesses going back long before this period, such as Asherah and Ishtar, were made offerings of cannabis ointments under the name Kanabu, the Assyrian name Kanabu. So it seems that this was a big part of Near Eastern goddess worship, was the burning of incense. And in the last of the references to cannabis pointed out by Sula Bennett, Jeremiah is saying, "What do I care from this cannabis from a distant land? Your sacrifices do not please me." And then in Jeremiah 44, the whole thing is concerned with the unholy daughters of Jerusalem burning incense to the Queen of Heaven and pouring out her drink offerings, right? And so it's pretty clear that this is how it all disappeared. It was favorable, then it kind of fell out. And this fits perfectly with the archaeology out of Arad. And I'm sure as archaeologists and historians there kick into this cannabis, and they've already been discussing these references. You know, it's ironic. I had a film, a documentary about this on YouTube. It was just over 600,000 views. And 2 weeks before this archaeology turned up, they banned it on YouTube for spreading false and misleading information.
Really?
And now, but they banned it for spreading false and misleading information. It was all like interviews with academics and stuff like that. Some probably evangelical butthole got uptight about it and started complaining or something like that, I'm guessing. But now with the archaeology, it's like, you know, it's harder to dismiss.
Yeah. Yeah.
And, you know, I got to say, the disappearance of the goddess and entheogens go hand in hand in the ancient world when you really start to look back, even in what happened with the Christian period. And that, I think, is probably the greatest theological crime of human history in the way it's made women second-class citizens for like 2,000 or 3,000 years. And degraded the divine feminine and allowed us to like turn our Mother Earth into a capitalistic ball that we can chip away at, you know?
Yeah, and then also projecting heaven or the exalted state as something that it transcends the physical world, that it's somewhere else, it's somewhere different, and that ultimately this is just you know, it's a testing ground for what comes later, but it's denying the access to the quote-unquote sacred through the plants and medicines that are available on Earth that have been associated with femininity. And we even see this, of course, you know, sort of parallel to the story of the Garden of Eden, where Eve is the one who eats the fruit of the tree of knowledge. And then, damn, fucking women. You got to put them in their place. It has to be a patriarchal system. And then you're ejected.
Yeah, that's one of the later things written in the Old Testament, too. You know, they put it in the front. But it's kind of written to kind of justify a lot of this activity that took place, you know, with the suppression of the goddess, you know. And not just like women, homosexuals as well. There used to be like the Quetishim, the male cult prostitutes, right in the temple. You know, the goddess worship was full of transvestite and trans people and all that type of stuff. And like in North American culture, where people that stood in the middle there were highly revered as shamans. That's happened all over the world. Happened in the Mideast too, you know, in Greek culture, in Phoenician culture, in all those cultures. So it's a painful thing that humanity's been through these patriarchal religions.
Definitely. So let's talk about choosing the title for the book. So in Liber 420, I was thinking, okay, Liber, that probably means book. It probably also means freedom. And I did a quick little search and actually found that it's also an alternate name for Dionysus, which I thought,
I didn't know that.
Oh, you didn't? Well, then I've just informed you of something that totally fits with your book because, you know, a lot of it is tracing the ancient origins. And this is something that is really important for people to understand is that none of these religions grew up in isolation from each other, that actually there was widespread trade, there was widespread interaction, and particularly among those who we might refer to as shamans or mystics or magicians, that those are the cats within religious structures that seem to be the least interested in dogmatism and the most interested in the practical application of spiritual experience. And that there was a lot of exchange all the way from the Mediterranean into Persia and into India, and then even all the way into China. So that all of this stuff was moving back and forth, and that they were all influencing each other, and that we have, in some instances, what appears to be the same god appearing in different cultures. So such as Shiva over in India is equated with Dionysus in the Hellenic world, which is also equated with Bacchus in the Roman world. And, you know, many kids grow up learning about Greek mythology and Roman mythology, and we hear about Dionysus and we hear about Bacchus, and we're told that, oh, well, this was the god of wine and drunken inebriation. And we now know that that wine is not modern day wine as we think of wine. And also all this talk about anointing oils. And so I'm going to invite you to comment on all this in just a moment. But, you know, when we get into anointing oils, which you've already mentioned, infused with cannabis, and of course, the very word Christ, the Christos, means the anointed one, and which just begs the question, well, then what the fuck was he anointed with? And why is that anointing so important? Yeah. That we often think of anointing as more the symbolic, you know, like the queen anointing somebody with a sword and I now dub you a knight. But in the ancient world, anointing actually meant to apply oil to someone. And that you trace all these roots and all of these sort of threads. So, so I invite you to jump in there anywhere you want on all of that.
Sure. You know, in regards to anointing, it's notable that one of the main points of contention between the groups we now know as Gnosticism and the Roman Catholic Church, which forms the basis of modern Christianity and were the authors of the New Testament, was water baptism versus anointing oil. And they say specifically, there's only water in the baptism. It's through the anointing oil that we are initiated into unfading bliss. They go drop down into water, but we get fire from the anointing oil. And then they prescribe it from a number of medical applications as well. So it's pretty clear that was a main point of contention in the divisions of Gnosticism and mainstream Christianity. And numbers of scholars have written about that as a point of deference, right? And yeah, in regards to Dionysius and Shiva, I just did a big article on... Go ahead.
I was just going to jump in and just for the listeners who are not aware that the Bible, as we know it, the Christian Bible was something that was compiled a couple hundred years after the theoretical time of Christ. And within that, there's only four Gospels. There's four canonical Gospels, but within the what have been deemed the Gnostic Christian churches, there's somewhere between 70 and maybe 100 different Gospels about Jesus, and they tell a completely different story than what's been canonized within the Catholic Bible, and that the Catholic Church itself, once it consolidated power, went through a purge where they actually went around and tried to find all of these other versions of Jesus and destroy them. And that's how we got the Nag Hammadi Library, where these Christian groups were like, well, shit, we've got to hide this stuff. And so they hid it in a cave, and then it wasn't discovered until the middle of the last century that we actually got access to these Gospels, which even talk about how Jesus, there was no resurrection. And even some of them take offense at suggesting that Jesus is even an actual person, saying, no, this is all spiritual allegory and symbolism, but it has nothing to do with a person dying on the cross. And it's not a religion about some dead dude that can't do anything for you. You know, so it's a completely different take on what Christianity was and could have been were it not for the consolidation of the Catholic Church.
Yeah, Gnostic's a pretty broad term, right? So there's a lot of different schools of Gnosticism. And like, it's hard to talk about solid beliefs under the block of Gnosticism. Right. But there's some commonalities, definitely, between different sects and stuff like that. But they can also be very, very opposite as well. Some are like fully into sexual orgies, and some are totally ascetic, for instance, you know. And I'm sure it was same with entheogenic use as well amongst Gnostic sects. And, you know, it's pretty clear from texts like the Book of Jude from the Bruce Codex that they were like burning incense and putting branches into wine and doing all sorts of stuff that is indications of entheogenic use, you know. You were mentioning Dionysus and Shiva, and I just did a big article on Dionysus and Shiva, and part of the reasons I wrote that was I had read Brian Marescu's new book, The Immortality Key, which suggests that early Christianity was influenced by the cult of Dionysius, and at the root of early Christianity is this drug infusion, you know? So I was going back over a lot of the material I'd written about Dionysius, and you know, looking at the stuff in Shiva, it's really incredible. We're going back, you know, like 2,500 years ago during the 2,400 years ago during the campaign of Alexander the Great into India. The followers of Dionysius in marching with Dionysius and the followers of Shiva embraced each other as brothers when they came into contact. And they had believed that when they were in one region of India where they were pressing grapes, they had arrived at ancient Nicaea, the childhood home of Dionysius, because it says, you know, in Greek myth, it refers to this place, Nicaea, which could have well been India. And so it was widely viewed that the two gods were one and the same in the ancient world. And, you know, and there's evidence that it could go back pre-Alexandrian, you know. And if that's the case, it likely does go back to a connection through Soma and other Indo-European counterparts of that, such as the Helmet in Persia, and numbers of scholars. I was surprised. I'd written a little bit about it 10 years ago when I wrote my book, Cannabis and the Soma Solution. I quoted a couple of different scholars that had written about a connection about Dionysus and Shiva. But when I was reviewing that material again, it was like a commonly held belief that there was a connection for like 75 years. I think even Encyclopedia Britannica and sources like that were writing about it in the 19th century. And then it just kind of got forgotten about. I think, you know, when drugs got kind of poo-pooed, the idea, you know, of drugs in religion just kind of got pushed aside. But for a while there in the 19th century among academics, there was a lot of talk about these sorts of substances because it was not the same sort of societal prejudices instilled yet. So they were looking at some of the ideas and evidence of this in a much more open mind.
Yeah, so maybe let's get in a little bit into Zoroastrianism, because that does seem to be somewhat of a root for a lot of these traditions, at least as you have uncovered with the use of cannabis. So maybe let's get into that a little bit.
Okay, well, Zoroastrianism grew out of this earlier religion, Mazdeanism. And Zoroaster was kind of a religious form, or kind of like Moses in the sense that he took the religion out of a kind of a polytheistic type of religion with all sorts of gods and goddesses and turned it into a monotheism. Some sources see Zoroastrianism as the first monotheistic religion. I don't know if monotheism really fits accurately. The initial religion, Mazdaism, was partakers of Haoma. Now, Haoma use continued in Zoroastrianism, but only after some serious reforms. And the modern day Zoroastrian Haoma is simply a preparation of this plant ephedra, which is the plant we get methamphetamine basis from, the stimulant. They drink kind of a tea of ephedra as Haoma. And it's likely that ephedra was part of the original Haoma. Myself, I've often pointed to the research by Russian archaeologist Victor Serianati, who says in the Bactria Marjana archaeological complex, which is in the northern regions of Afghanistan, he's found three temples, and half the temple site was dedicated to making a sacred beverage. And from the evidence he recovered there, the indications are cannabis, ephedra, and in some cases, poppy. There's been debate about the methods of analogy used by Serianati and his team. But there's been other archaeological evidence that has substantiated it in the form of Scythian gold cups. Scythians in that region were referred to by the name Haoma Varga, which means Haoma gatherers. And they found, you know, we know the Scythians used to burn cannabis in braziers, in little tents, and there's been archaeological evidence of this, and Herodotus wrote about it in the 5th century BC. We now also know they drank cannabis because we found these golden goblets with residues of cannabis and poppy. I don't know if they checked for ephedra. There's been other finds of a bone cup with cannabis residues and a flask with bits of cannabis in it among Scythians. We also know that this region at BMAT was in contact with, you mentioned China earlier, and there's been evidence out of China recently in a number of tombs of a culture known as the Gushi culture. And these, again, were Indo-European language-speaking people, like the people at the Bactria Marjana archaeological complex and the Scythians. And at this region here, we found evidence of both cannabis and ephedra in tombs. And also, we found artifacts from this region in China over in this region, Bactria Marjana archaeological complex, and vice versa, as well as Chinese artifacts among the Scythians. My view is that the Chinese term for cannabis, and the Taoist Chinese started picking up mystical use at this time, calling cannabis one of the superior plants of immortality. The Chinese name for cannabis was Hu Ma, translated variously as Scythian cannabis or fire cannabis, i.e. cannabis that you burnt. And we know they were burning it there because we recovered braziers with burnt cannabis out of it. And that linguistic name traveled with the Scythian Haoma Varga into the Bactria Marjana archaeological complex where Serianati sees these temples for the preparation of soma. Now, Zoroaster, he was uptight about what he saw as orgiastic activities of the Haoma cult. And you got to remember, they're mixing all this with ephedra, which is quite a powerful stimulant. So it's a cannabis, poppy, and ephedra mix. And they were having all night sexual kind of tantric rituals, according to ancient sources, you know. He directly references, you know, Scythian influences on this as well. And so there were these major reforms of the Haoma, and I think that's where it became denatured. However, some cannabis use continued in Zoroastrian circles amongst the Zoroastrian elite. And we know this because of there's numbers of references such as the Book of Ardu Viraf, the Tale of Vishtaspa, the Dankert, and other texts where they refer to cannabis being mixed with Haoma or mixed with wine. And these were actual preparations that Zoroaster himself was said to have prepared. His wife at one time prays that Zoroaster may give her good thoughts, good words, and good deeds so that she might be blessed with his good medicine, bonga, cannabis, right? And so this was one of the main points of religious, gaining religious knowledge, right? In the Book of Ardu Viraf, he's given seven cups, gold cups of cannabis infused wine. He drinks it and he's knocked out for a couple of days. And then he comes back and he reveals the whole story of heaven and hell, mm-hmm. and how he saw the righteous rewarded in heaven and the evil punished, you know? And this is right in the Zoroastrian literature, you know, and this is like pre-Christian concepts of these ideas. And we know the Zoroastrian religion influenced both Judaism and Christianity in a number of cosmological concepts. So it's not out of question to see this origin of heaven and hell being the origin of the Christian heaven and hell, and the concept of heaven being no more real than the Aboriginal dream time, where they think that dreams are as real as this reality, you know, because it's based on drug experience. You know, you really leave the body, is there the whole time, you know, and we can see this use continuing in the Persian region up until the time of the Hashishin. That is basically the story of the Hashishin. He initiates them. They wake up in a garden paradise, think they've died, and they come back. It's all a replay of this earlier Zoroastrian mythology. And it's interesting in the sense of Christianity, evangelism, when we talk about Vistaspa, the first king, Zoroaster's own first initiate, was this king Vistaspa. At the time of the Christianity, there was a prohibited document. It was called the Oracle of Hystaspes, Hystaspes being the Greek version of Vistaspa. And it predicted the fall of Rome, much like the Book of Revelation did, but recalled it Babylon. And the guy that had that revelation, the Oracle of Hystaspes, which is known to have influenced the Book of Revelation, was high on cannabis when he had that revelation.
Yeah. And, you know, even in terms of just direct historical influence from one to the other. So we have Zoroastrianism, this ancient Persian religion, which is part of the Indo-European language family, which then also includes India, Sanskrit, that is part of the Indo-European language family, then also Greek and Latin are part of the Indo-European language family. So we see a lot of the similar terms being used linguistically. So like in India, we have Amrita. In Greek, we have ambrosia. Yeah. And then in the time of the Christian era, that Zoroastrianism had then been also reformed into Manichaeism with the prophet Mani, who claimed to be the reincarnation of Zoroaster, Buddha, and Christ, and that the father of Christian theology, St. Augustine of Hippo, was a member of the Manichaeist religion before he converted to Christianity. And then he was basically the guy who reinterpreted the story of the Garden of Eden as implicating original sin, and that the dead and resurrected Jesus was the second Adam that atoned for the sin of the original Adam of eating the fruit of the tree of knowledge. And that then became the doctrinal foundation of Catholic Christianity, which, you know, has removed the world. And then, you know, he wrote his book, there's the city of God and the city of man, and that earthly existence and sexuality is all sin, that this is all part of original sin. And through the death and resurrection of Jesus, which we've already established was contested among early Christians, whether that's even a real thing, he made that the official doctrine, and that became the official interpretation of the Catholic Church, which then now modern evangelicals are a long way from that. But that set the foundation for their version of what the world is, what heaven is, what the afterlife is, what sin is, and all of that. And they took the cannabis out of the equation.
Yeah. You know, Manichaeans were like accused by the Chinese of using cannabis in the 12th century AD. They had these all-night incense houses, and the Chinese made a play on the term cannabis and spirit is very similar, one's ma and one's mo. And the Manichaeans referred to themselves as spirit father and spirit mother, but in mocking them, the Chinese referred to them as the cannabis father and the cannabis mother in relation to their all-night incense events. So it's interesting to see where it did survive. And I think a lot of the heresies of the Middle Ages may have been related to some of the sort of similar sort of ideas with the Cathars and other sects that may have retained some sort of Gnostic knowledge.
Yeah, so that's, you know, also this part of your book here, we've got the Cathars, which was in, I believe, southern France and then Spain, which is kind of a resurgence of Gnosticism. You also get into the Knight Templars. You get into the Green Man mythology. You get into, again, Puck as a resurgence of Pan, and also talking about Shakespeare. And I know you're also into modern magical practices. I mean, we can't talk about the whole history of the world in one podcast episode, but it certainly is a great thread, that this cannabis thread, and even the fact that cannabis is so versatile. I mean, even by saying thread, that, you know, it makes thread, right? You can make clothing out of it. You can make products out of it. You can eat it. You can use it to get high. You can have religious experience for it. You can also use it as a medicine. It's no wonder that the ancients were enamored with this plant, because there isn't any other plant on the planet that has as many uses. Plus, it's got this really profound spiritual component to it, that it alters your consciousness, that you get to go places with it.
You know, like, as far as the Western magical tradition goes, it starts with cannabis, because it's really the Picatrix, which is the foundational document of the Western magical tradition. And the Picatrix is a 12th century Latin translation done by King Alfonso of a 10th century Arabic book of magic known as Gayat al-Hakim. And cannabis is mentioned in the Picatrix as burnt, mixed with stag's blood and other things. And then you would burn it, and you would talk to the messenger of the moon and the pillar of smoke of, like, it was like a pound of cannabis resin that you were burning, not any small amount. It specifically asked for cannabis resin and like a pound of it, you know? So it was like a heavy amount, heavy fumigation, you know? You got to think too, like, none of these people, I'm sure, were like habitual or, you know, everyday users of cannabis. Cannabis was a rare and prized commodity that was reserved for things like magical ceremony or temple use. The price of it, I'm sure, in the ancient world was astronomical. It was traveling along the spice route. And these mummies that they found in China, they've changed what we know about the trade in the ancient world. You know, before it was thought it was started about 95 BC, the spice trail. Now it's been put back about 2,000 years before that. And we can be sure that cannabis resins were a major commodity of the spice trail. The references to Canna refer to it coming from a distant land, and the archaeologists in Arad agree that it was an imported item, that there's no evidence of it growing in the Holy Land in pollen samples from different depths of soil and stuff like that. They can see what growing in an area or what was growing, and it was clearly an imported item in those days, both from the etymological and archaeological evidence available. So it was likely coming out of that region in China and servicing a wide variety of cults and people all the way into India, where it arrived as Soma. And a lot of the prohibitions of Soma actually were initiated because of the poor quality of the product that was arriving on the carts that brought it from afar. It wasn't initially grown in India. We know that cannabis wasn't an indigenous crop to India because, again, of pollen samples and stuff like that. It's grown there. It came to be grown there, like it can be grown in much of the rest of the ancient world. But initially, it was an imported product. And they were on the end of the trail as it became more and more popular. And then it was, you know, getting stepped on and false fake plants to be replaced or other entheogens. And this is where all the confusion and how it becomes prohibited and lost is all tied up with this element of trade.
So would you agree with the assessment that hemp is probably the first plant that humans started cultivating?
Well, Carl Sagan suggested that, Terence McKenna as well. Other people have suggested it. We have evidence of hemp fiber rope from 24,000 BC. Elizabeth Whalen Barber, who's probably the foremost expert on ancient textiles, has pointed at tools that she says were used for breaking up the fibers of hemp to make it into fiber and cloth and stuff like that from 28,000 BC. We have evidence of hemp cloth, 12,000, 10,000 BC. And then the earliest evidence we have of cannabis used for ritual purposes is probably about 3,500 BC. you know, yeah, it could well be. It's like, you know, like it's hard to say, but I think that it's a very likely possibility. Certainly, like Sagan, he pointed to the pygmies in Africa who were basically hunter gatherers until they started using cannabis ritually, and they couldn't count on finding that in the wild. It was something that was introduced to them by Arabic traders. And so they started growing it around their huts and stuff like that, you know? There's another theory that beer, which was another toxicant of the ancient world, was humanity's first agricultural crop. And I think that's what Brian Marescu suggests in his book, The Immortality Key. I think the evidence for cannabis is a little stronger with the archaeological evidence I suggested. I doubt that was prepared from just wild cannabis, those forms of cloth. It was probably already cultivated and may have well been in use for a long time before that. You know, we just don't know because we don't have archaeological evidence for it.
Yeah. The great part about archaeological evidence is that more keeps showing up all the time and we never know what we're going to find. And I mean, you've mentioned like these tombs in China that have, it's only recently that many of these tombs have been uncovered, and they've found like pounds of marijuana in some of these tombs and ancient grave sites with, you know, just shamanic like figures.
Whole plants placed on a guy's chest, a brazier that was burnt cannabis, and it was all female cannabis and not bad quality cannabis. So they were specifically, you know, looking for its psychoactive content.
Yeah, it's pretty clear by the plants themselves. So let's jump up in time a little bit, because it's kind of a fun topic to talk about. That I think it was a couple of years ago that an article came out saying we've found Shakespeare's pipe and it has cannabis resin in it. And so let's talk a little bit about Shakespeare and the possible influences of cannabis the works of Shakespeare.
I interviewed both the professors that suggested that. And it goes back 20 years. It just comes up in the news every few years. Somebody does some new story about it. Okay. And they had a theory based on one of his sonnets about noted weed, that he was a cannabis smoker. And being professors, they were able to get the Avon Trust in Avalon, I think it is, to release pipe fragments that had been found on the property where Shakespeare is believed to have lived from the time period he lived in. And using gas chromotherapy, which is what the police used for testing for evidence, they found strong evidence of cannabis use, as well as, in some cases, possibly cocaine, and I forget what the other plant was, but the strongest and most common thing that was found was evidence that cannabis had been burnt in these pipes. Shakespeare does make reference to hemp. He has Puck talk about what hemp and homespuns do we have here, you know, as a line from a Midsummer Dream. And Puck is also known as Robin Goodfellow, and he's even referred to as Robin Goodfellow in A Midsummer Night's Dream. Yes. And Robin Goodfellow, who's kind of a pan-like fellow, has a long history of hemp. In fact, Robin Goodfellow's own catchphrase was hemp and hampin'. Another figure in A Midsummer Night's Dream is Oberon, Prince of the Fairies. And in a poetry written before Shakespeare, they're referred to riding hemp stalks to the, you know, through the air, kind of like witches' brooms. And there's a 16th century a grimoire that's been republished as the Book of Oberon because it has invocations of Oberon. And it also has, I mentioned it earlier, because it also has a recipe for a cannabis-infused ointment for seeing visions in magic mirrors. As well as other drug recipes for seeing the dead and things like that. So it's pretty clear that there's some sort of a awareness on Shakespeare's part in the way that he incorporated these figures into A Midsummer Night Dream, and awareness of their cannabis history combined with the evidence provided by these pipes. It's very intriguing. Some of the poems about Robin Goodfellow are hilarious. It describes him, you know, like banging a housemaid on a pile of hemp because they used to have to smash the hemp to break the fibers from the stalk. The way he'd do it is he'd like lay down some maiden on there and have sex for a few hours, and then all the hemp would be broken up and ready to be spun. You know, and there's like, speaking of spinning, there's the whole story of what's his name there, the troll that you weren't supposed to remember his name that spun gold from hay there. You know, the story where he weaves the gold from the hay?
Yeah, is that Rumpelstiltskin?
Rumpelstiltskin, yeah. And the original tales of Rumpelstiltskin, some of these, you know, fairy tales, they go back to ancient times. Yeah. And in some of the regional stories of Rumpelstiltskin, some of the earlier tales, he's actually weaving hemp thread, golden thread from hemp, not gold from hay, you know, which hay would never see a spinning wheel. You never weaved any cloth from hemp. It would always be, I mean, I never weaved any cloth from hay. It would always be hemp or some other fiber. But in some of the earlier regional tales, he spins gold thread from hemp.
Mm. And it certainly sounds like Robin Goodfellow had his work cut out from him if he had to have vigorous enough sex to actually break apart the stalks. Because all of us, you know,
I
all
think
of
he
us,
enjoyed his work from the accounts.
Yeah, I think so.
He seems like a pretty merry fellow.
but we all know that those stems are, they're pretty stiff. They're pretty hard. So that's some pretty vigorous lovemaking. Just a completely random side note, I'm just curious if when you were down here in Ashland a few years ago for the Exploring Psychedelics Conference, you know, we do have the Ashland Shakespeare Festival, which who knows if it's going to survive coronavirus or not. But in downtown Ashland, we do have Oberon's Tavern. I'm just curious if you had a chance to visit Oberon's Tavern while you were down here.
Yeah, no, I didn't visit. I probably wasn't aware of it then. I don't think I quite started work on Liber 420 then, so I hadn't looked into a lot of that stuff. But I don't actually drink alcohol, so I don't really go into a lot of bars.
Yeah, well, it's just a fun place. It bills itself as the most Ashlandiest place in Ashland. And you know,
oh, nice.
You know, the people who serve there, you know, they all dress in like Renaissance attire and, you know, huzzah and all of that. So it's all Shakespeare themed, but you know, it's Oberon's Tavern. And of course, we were just talking about Oberon, who's the king of the fairies, in A Midsummer Night's Dream.
Yeah.
Yeah.
You know, another kind of figure, kind of like Shakespeare, is Francois Rabelais. And I dedicated Liber 420 to Francois Rabelais in his famous parody of the Grail myths, Gargantua and Pantagruel, which tells the tale of the giant Pantagruel trying to escort his pal Panurge, who's worried about being a cuckold, to find this mythical elixir that reveals the truth to you, the holy bottle. And in his tale, he incorporated three chapters under the title The Herb Pantagruelian, which we now know are descriptions of cannabis. He goes, reuses some of Pliny's stuff and some of the other old author's stuff, enough that we could tell that he's actually talking about cannabis. But he also refers to its transcendental nature and refers to himself as the master of the quintessence. And quintessences came up a lot in my book because these were alchemical tinctures that were made by alchemists infused with herbs. And we have numbers of recipes for cannabis quintessences coming from figures like Paracelsus, Zosimos, Cardano, and other alchemical figures. So you can be sure that's what Rabelais was referring to. And he makes this whole Dionysian connection. The bottle is located in India, but it's in a temple of Dionysius in India. And when he drinks the bottle, he has a whole prophetic experience, you know what I mean? So he's directly kind of connecting these sort of infused wines and the grail and that all together. And you mentioned that I mentioned the Templars, who come up a lot in Rabelais' tale and who are connected with the original grail mythology. And there's long been claims I've seen on the internet about a Templar wine infusion that contained cannabis and aloe vera. Mixed with hemp into palm wine. And if you look up cannabis, hemp, and aloe wine, you'll find this in all sorts of aloe vera books that they make reference to this infusion of wine and aloe in hemp that was used by the Templars. I couldn't find any time period references to this wine directly, but strangely enough, what I did find in references from the period of the Templars is that the Templars had Saracens, Arabs, growing cannabis for them in Spain. And, you know, it's not a region or a people that you would be having growing fiber cannabis. So it's clearly they were growing resin cannabis specifically. And in the records of items seized from the Templars in the raids that happened in both France and England, there's long records of all the items seized from the locations, is large, a few pounds of cannabis from each raid. And it just describes it as cannabis. It doesn't give it, you know, if it was cloth, it would have been described as cloth or rope. The fact that it's just described as raw cannabis indicates that there may be some indications that the Templars had picked up the sacramental use of cannabis while in the Holy Land. And combined with that, we have the 1250 record of Villar de Honnecart, the portfolio of Villar de Honnecart, who was in the Holy Land at the same time as the Templars, and his Masonic journal. There's actually a Masonic lodge, the Villar de Honnecart Masonic Lodge in France now. And his journal, which is mostly about Arabic building techniques, there is one page of text in that document, and that one page of text is a recipe for a cannabis-infused wine.
So that actually brings me to kind of a meta question for you. I just wanted to ask you about how you go about doing all of this research and looking at these documents. And of course, there's lots of questions of translation. I know that our mutual friend, Tom Hatzis, appears here and there in Liber 420. Tell us a little bit about this process of going through all of these different documents coming from many different cultures with many different languages of origin. How do you sort through it all? And when do we know we have a good translation? And I think that's an important question.
You know, that's a fair question, you know, because I'm not a professor or trained in any languages and stuff like that. Well, for instance, let's say how, like, in Liber 420, I have a lot of alchemical recipes that have never appeared before. And we happen to live in this incredible age of information, with incredible search tools, you know, and we can use things like Google specifically to look at books, and more specifically to look at books in any sort of year time period we choose, 1600 to 1650, 1650 to 1700. And we can search those books. And when it comes to a term like cannabis in Latin, that's used in those time periods a lot, it's either spelt the same as it is or variations of that. If you know the different variations, you can just drop those into the search engines, right? And so you throw those in and lots of material comes up. Mm-hmm. A lot of it's just references to fiber hemp farming techniques, and it's hard to tell because it's all in Latin, you know. You can get a rough idea by using another great tool, translators, you know. Unfortunately, Latin to English isn't so great for translating, but you can get at least a rough idea of what is being discussed. And then you can take a look at the author. Who's the author of the book you're looking at? Figure out who he is. Well, if it's a famous alchemist like Paracelsus, it's worth looking at a little deeper. So then you excerpt the material, and in a lot of cases, pay a translator to translate it. I've dropped a lot of money on translations in the writing of both of my books, you know, getting professional translations done of material after narrowing it down to a few documents, which takes me a lot of, like, going through a lot of stuff and, you know, filtering it down, and this looks like it's got something to it. Sometimes it's crap, you know what I mean? Sometimes it's very interesting material, like I got in regards to the alchemical references that I got, right? And you can also do searches like, you know, going to Google Books, and you do obscure searches on things like saying hemp and soma or hemp and haoma. And everywhere those words appear together over the last, you know, whatever, like, there's, you got to think, like, in a feature like Google Books, they've got like libraries and libraries and libraries full of books scanned in and entered into that huge database. And so not every single book ever written is in there, but probably most of them are by now. And yeah, you come up with a whole wealth of material that's otherwise been forgotten. 19th century authors, like I mentioned, wrote about a lot of this stuff. And they were very astute in their knowledge. It wasn't like they didn't have bad knowledge. It's just that it kind of got forgotten and left by the wayside, you know. But if you take it, and then you start looking at some of that stuff, and you find somebody's independently come to the same conclusions in the modern time without even knowing about these earlier authors, right? You know what I mean?
Yeah.
And so you get the whole wealth of it. And I probably got OCD or something like that. So anytime I do a search like that, I end up going through everything with a fine tooth comb that I can. A lot of times even, you know, maybe you just get a little clipping of what's in the book, but it looks so interesting, you have to use Google again and do some massive book finding search engine and find that book in a rare little bookstore over in Paris or something like that. And you got to email the guy and get that book sent over to you and then get that translated. You know what I mean? As there was a wealth of French material, this last book, Libre 420. And I had worked closely with a French translator, Pierre Charette, who translated a whole book that we came across by Ernest Bosque, theoretical book of hashish or something like that, that was written in 1920. He ended up translating a whole book that we came across. It just happens, like, you know, people couldn't have written books like I wrote 20 years ago because there was just not the access to information available at your fingertips like there is now, that you can pursue from wherever you live if you've got an internet connection. And I'm not talking like crazy internet sites and stuff like that. I'm talking like serious books and academic papers. There's also Google Scholar, so you can just search academic papers and stuff like that. And also puts you into communication with a lot of people. And I'm always, when I'm writing about a particular group like Zoroastrianism or alchemy, I'm always reaching out to people that are noted experts in those fields and sending them what I've got, getting to tell me what they think, where I think I might be wrong or right, that sort of thing, right? And so it's really key just in this time period and time place that books like my own could even be produced because of the incredible access to internet. And you know what? It's funny, one of the Zoroastrian prophecies of the end time is that each man shall look at the other and they will know what they have done, you know, and see them. And it's almost kind of like that in the connectivity, you know. It's like there's a story of Indra's web, and at each intersection of the web, you can see every other intersection. And really, the internet's brought us together in a way that we've never been able to connect and communicate before. And I think that's one of the beautiful things of technology.
Yeah. And it's really nice to hear that you are sharing your materials with people that you consider to be experts in those particular topics, that, you know, that you're really trying to stay away from speculation, that you're really looking at where is the best available evidence. And, you know, you're really upfront about that within the book. And I really appreciate that this is a multi-pronged effort and that you're looking at a wide variety of sources. And even though you have not gone through the educational system yourself, you are still definitely utilizing the same techniques of peer review, looking at scholarly sources, looking at university sources, which definitely lends credibility to the book. How long did it take to write this 792-page book?
Well, I spent a couple of years on that, but you know, I couldn't have written that without all the other stuff that I've written before, you know what I mean? I only write about this one thing, the role of cannabis in magic and religion. This is my fourth book. My first one on it came out in 1995, right? And there's stuff in that book that's in this later book, you know what I mean? And so it's kind of like a lifetime compilation of it. And then you also get into the situation when you really know a subject like this, when you come across a reference, you can connect that references to all this other material because you've already covered, oh, that must connect to this because these guys knew those guys, and boom, boom, boom. You know what I mean? So it's more of like a lifetime effort. I couldn't have written that book in 2 years without the previous, you know, 28 years of knowledge and stuff like that I'd accumulated.
Yeah. So it's a really seasoned approach then to it, that it's taking everything that you've learned over the past three decades and all of the source material and all of these connections and then presenting it as a unified package. But it's not a singular effort in and of itself. It's the result of really just decades and decades of work.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah. Well, I certainly can recommend the book. I mean, it's fascinating. I mean, I could just be sitting here digging through this book for a long time because there's so much amazing information in it. But I already had you on for, you know, over an hour. So I want to just shift gears a little bit and let's kind of wrap it up by talking a little bit about the Soma Institute and, you know, kind of what your vision is for that. And I'm sure it's probably curtailed or at least on hold to some degree with coronavirus. But, you know, let's talk about what you yourself are doing in your personal life with the Soma Institute.
Yeah, well, Soma Institute actually, you know, came about because I was worried about my shop, the Urban Shaman, getting shut down. And it was an entheogenic shop I had in Vancouver for like 19 years. And I provided the plants for making ayahuasca, peyote, kratom, blue lotus, all sorts of plants. And was somehow able to navigate the system for quite a while. Unfortunately, I could always see that as legalization came into effect and they started paying attention a lot more to small shops and things like that, as a result, looking for licensing and things, that there was getting to be increased interest in what I was doing and that my shop was likely going to be, you know, that it wouldn't necessarily last forever. So I started thinking, well, what am I going to do if I'm not doing the Urban Shaman? Well, one of the things out here in BC is people looking for places to hold ceremonies and have entheogenic experiences. And so I came up with this idea of Soma Institute, and I got a few acres in the mountains with my partner, Celine Archibald. We have this place here with like a log house, half a dozen cabins, 25-foot teepee, greenhouses, hot wood-fired hot tub, wood-fired sauna. And it's a beautiful, beautiful piece of land. And we rent it out to people in the entheogenic plant community to even kind of come here. You have to have some sort of connection that we can verify and find out where it is. And unfortunately, COVID's kind of limited. You know, we've only allowed small groups, no more than 12 people, but we could easily handle 25 if we wanted to here. It's really kind of curtailed things in a big way. You know, right now we're not having any guests because things with COVID are so bad. But hopefully if that blows over, we'll be able to kick that back into gear. And we have things like Colorado River toads here, which we hope to breed. And we hope to one day see the greenhouses filled with a variety of entheogenic plants and act as a sort of nursery for their preservation and make this property kind of an arc for entheogenic culture and plants that can hopefully survive any cataclysms that are on the horizon and maintain a wealthy library and hub of these things for future generations.
Yeah, well, I really love the idea that you want to have a greenhouse because I've always thought that having some kind of shamanic a botanical garden, it just seems like a no-brainer. It's like somebody's got to do it and put together a garden that actually has all these plants where you can see them in their original living form and also just for preservation purposes.
Yeah, absolutely. I think it needs to happen. Absolutely. The way things are going in the world, we've had a couple of close calls already. So I think it's important to happen in a number of areas on the globe.
Yeah. So is the Urban Shaman gone now? Or are you no longer running the shop?
Urban Shaman is gone, unfortunately. You know, we ran into some problems with Health Canada, and we were worried about, they were concerned particularly about kratom, which is rather sad because the Lower East Side, where the Urban Shaman was located, probably is one of the biggest hubs for hardcore heroin and fentanyl deaths and overdoses and addiction in North America, probably the world even. And many, many, many people are finding relief from opiate addiction through kratom.
Yeah.
And they were like continually pressuring us on the issue of us selling kratom. And they said, and you know, don't think just because we're talking about kratom now, we're not concerned about other plants that you provide as well. And I was, you know, increasingly concerned that might draw unwanted attention to plants that are currently not scheduled and not under the watchful eye of Health Canada, and lead to a situation where some of those plants would fall under the, some sort of pogrom that Health Canada and that was now pursuing against kratom.
Yeah, wow. So you've already mentioned that cannabis is legal in Canada, and it's one of the places where, like 5-MeO, it's not scheduled in Canada. So I know that a lot of people travel to Canada in order to experience 5-MeO, whether through the Sonoran Desert Toad or through the Pure Molecule. And I remember going into your shop in Vancouver, and I certainly, I noticed the peyote plants. And but what can you tell us about the legal status of entheogens and psychedelics in general right now in Canada and how things are looking?
Well, in Vancouver, the city council unanimously just passed a bill to decriminalize the possession of all drugs. And so something will probably come out of that on the municipal level. Peyote is legal in Canada. When you look up the schedule of controlled drugs, it says mescaline, but it specifically says, but not peyote. And this was because they were going to have to create a religious exemption for peyote for Native American church members and other indigenous groups that used it. And they were worried that would create a precedent where other people might be able to pursue religious exemptions in the courts. So they just left it off the schedule because it was so hard to get in Canada. It's illegal to import any cactus of any kind into Canada. Recently, over the last year, a project that was started here at Soma Institute, we got together a petition. In Canada, you can petition the federal government. There's a process for this, and you have to get a member of parliament to represent your petition. And if you get over 500 signatures, they will discuss whatever the petition is on the floor of parliament here in Canada. And so we put together a petition based on the sacramental history of these sorts of plants and human interactions with them, that they should be decriminalized based on that. And this petition got the support of a number of well-known individuals, such as Gabor Maté, Dennis McKenna, just trying to think of the guy, Wade Davis, and other individuals got on board with this petition, and a guy named Trevor Miller really championed promoting it. And he got well over the 500 required signatures, something upwards of 15,000. And so this is set to be, you know, when politics comes back and they're having a bit more going on, is set to be a topic of discussion in Canada. And the Liberal government in charge right now is the same Liberal government that legalized cannabis. And so there is hope that this will at least get the discussion going for these substances and start to pave the way. There's also been an exemption granted in Canada for the therapeutic, the study for the therapeutic use of psilocybin mushrooms, where 15 therapists have been given an exemption to work with and study psilocybin mushrooms. And that's just happened recently here in Canada. So I think Canada is leading the way, and Vancouver has really become a hub of psychedelic culture with people like Dennis McKenna and Gabor Maté and Mark Hayden and other individuals really picking up the torch on these issues in a way that, say, somebody like myself, a more grassroots type of activist, is unable to do.
Yeah. And so now you're out at the Soma Institute, and that's, I assume that's outside of Vancouver. You're kind of out in the woods, aren't you?
Yeah, I'm about 4 hours away from Vancouver, about 45 minutes away from even a small town. So it's pretty wild times, but it's really cool out here as well. It's a really great place for writing and researching, that's for sure.
Yeah, not a lot of distractions, huh?
Yeah, not a lot of distractions.
Yeah, and I saw on Facebook earlier today, it looks like it snowed out your way.
Yeah, we've got a bit of snow. You know, you can get like 3-4 feet out here in the peak of it, you know, for a few months, say, you know, end of December through to end of February, it could be like 2 or 3 feet of snow out here, no problem.
Yeah. All right. Well, hope you stay well supplied with wood and gas and other elements that you need to stay warm through that.
We got it all here.
Yeah. All right. Well, anything you want to wrap us up with? Anything that we absolutely need to discuss before I sign off with you?
No, you know, if you search my name in cannabis, you'll come up with lots of articles and videos and things like that. If you want to check out more of my work or, you know, follow me on Facebook, I'm always posting whatever I'm coming across. I'm always digging around in archaeology and history and digging up new stuff. It's pretty standard for my existence. So, if you want to check any of that out, it's pretty easy to find me.
Yeah. And of course, the book we've been discussing today is Liber 420. Subtitle is Cannabis, Magical Herbs, and the Occult. And you all, of course, are also the author of Cannabis and the Soma Solution, which is really looking at Soma in India and a lot of the same history that we've been talking about today. And what are your other books that you have?
I got another one, Sex, Drugs, Violence in the Bible, and I discussed a lot of the cannabossum material in that. And then my first book was, which came out in 1995, was Green Gold, The Tree of Life, Marijuana and Magic and Religion. And it's really kind of like a prologue of everything I wrote afterwards. You know, I cover all those elements in that book, but much more detail in the books that followed later as my areas of knowledge expanded in those areas.
All right. Well, great. Thank you so much for your time today, Chris. I'm glad that we were able to work this out on Zoom and that transmission was relatively stable throughout our talk. But it's been great to see you and connect with you again today.
Always a pleasure. Martin, take care of yourself.
Yeah, and please give my best to Selena as well.